You are listening to KFAI, that's 90.3 FM, and live on the web at kfai.org. This is Annie Harview. I am so excited to be here tonight with Jai Chakrabarty, author of the excellent new novel, A Play at the End of the World. Welcome to KFAI, Jai.
So great to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks. Let's just dive right into talking about the book. Could you briefly describe the story for anyone who hasn't got their hands on it yet?
Sure. A Play for the End of the World is a love story. It's also a story about how art has an influence on politics and the shape of our lives. And more specifically, it's about a survivor from the Warsaw Ghetto who travels to India in 1972 to stage a play from his youth. And he's caught between his allegiance to the villagers in India and to the love of his life, Lucy, a woman from the American South.
So this novel centers on a fictional community, Yarik, Lucy, who have been discussed, but additionally features actual historical figures like Janusz Korczak and Rabindranath Tagore, and they also play important roles. So could you tell me about how kind of a research process and a fiction process overlapped as you created this story?
Yeah, so this novel is a work of historical fiction, and I did quite a lot of research in Poland in the 1940s, India in the 1970s, and New York as well in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so for Poland, you know, I looked at a number of primary sources, like, for example, the diary of Janusz Korczak. Janusz Korczak was a children's educator. He ran an orphanage with 200 children in Warsaw. And so there was a lot of text about his life, about how he thought about art, how he thought about community that was really valuable to me in my research. And of course, I spent time in Warsaw tracing his steps, if you will. And then there was the research that came about in India, and India in the 1970s, late 1960s, was a politically very challenging moment for the country. There was quite a lot happening in the political arena in India at the time. And so that was a wonderful period of research for me to uncover some aspects of my own family history. Mm-hmm. And how did I layer sort of the research with the fiction? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about this in terms of a phrase that was coined by the writer Robert Boswell called the half-known world, mm-hmm. where he talks about providing just enough of the facts so that your mm-hmm. reader feels like he's or she is in the room with you, but mm-hmm. that you have enough room to also imagine. And so it's really about finding that right balance between mm-hmm. fact and imagination.
Yeah, well, I think that felt very evident as I read the book. It was very clear that the Warsaw and the India and New York all felt very different and very vivid in their own ways. They all had kind of their own energy. So just wanted to applaud that quickly. Let's talk a little more about Yarik. So it seems, and for those who, again, haven't read the book yet, this was touched on a little at the top, but Yarik is quite literally a Holocaust survivor. He escaped concentration camp. He made it to the United States. And it seems that a lot of his decisions, even now that he has a far more stable life, has a job, has a relationship, has a safe place to live, are shaped by his past trauma. And that trauma also shapes the way he relates to the other human beings in his life, both romantic and in professional or social contexts. Could you tell a little bit about your process of creating and embodying this character?
Yeah, so Yarik's character was unlike any that I'd written before in my fiction. And it was a journey for me to really feel like I could live inside of him and tell his story. And what I found through my research and through my character development for Yarik and the other characters in this novel mm-hmm. is that there's so many different ways in which we can approach trauma. Mm-hmm. And the way in which Mishka, Yarik's great friend, approaches his life is very different, you know, and Misha is someone who is gregarious, who is celebrating at every opportunity, who wants to bring community close together. Mm-hmm. And he wants to go back and think about that shared past that they had. He wants to look at the history of what happened in Warsaw. Mm-hmm. Yarik, you know, is very different. He'd rather not think about it at all. Mm-hmm. And he finds great safety in the regular rhythms of his life. Mm-hmm. And so when that's disrupted, things start to fall apart for him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think for me, one of the most useful writing tips that I discovered was to write in Yarik's voice. Even though this mm-hmm. novel is told in the third person point of view, mm-hmm. I found it to be extremely helpful to write as if I was speaking in Yarik's voice and keeping his journal. So I have a book-sized journal of just of Yarik talking about his life, you know, and that was deeply helpful for me in getting close to his character.
This is obviously radio is not a visual medium, but I truly clasped my hands to my chest because that's like a great idea. That's very sweet to embody the characters so much that you create a journal for them. And this is a point that I want to expound on in something that I noticed and that felt very important to me as I read the book. So a lot of the book is third person, but it does focus in on specific characters' experiences and specific characters' points of view. Much of the book is from Yarik's point of view. Also, a fair bit of the book is from Lucy's point of view. And it was fascinating to me as an artistic choice that the death of Misha. So basically the family, I guess, like, I kind of thought of him as like Yarik's main friend and Yarik's main family. The death of Misha was initially announced and the emotions around it were initially discussed during a section that Lucy was leading. And that felt really salient to me because it was like, so it's not Yarik initially unpacking these reactions and these feelings for us in that moment. Could you tell me a little bit about what that tells us about Yarik's sense of self, how Yarik deals with new trauma or new change in the world, and why you chose to make that artistic decision, especially like especially in this conversation, it feels so clear to me that you could have written it from Yarik's perspective. You've got the receipts, you've got Yarik's whole diary, you're all in. So this was clearly a choice was made.
Yeah, I love the question, firstly.
Thanks.
And, you know, I think about a book like The Great Gatsby, where F. Scott Fitzgerald chooses to have Nick Carraway as our narrator, mm-hmm. and how that's such an effective choice, because mm-hmm. we effectively get someone who can tell the story in a way in which we see the various emotional complexities mm-hmm. Of the other characters, you know. And I think if I were to have tried to do that with mm-hmm. Yarik talking about his experience of losing Misha, mm-hmm. I don't think Yarik in that moment would have had access to the layers of emotional strife that mm-hmm. he's going through the, you know, immediate trauma of losing a friend. I don't think he would have had access to that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Lucy, as someone who deeply loves him and mm-hmm. cares for him, I think is going to be able to provide a much more balanced picture for the reader. Mm-hmm. So that's why I did that.
Yeah, that's such a good idea. And I was thinking as I read, like, if while this is happening to Yarik, he probably can't narrate it to himself very effectively at all. It seems that that is the nature of hardship for him. So to kind of jump a continent away from where Lucy is, away from New York, over to India. The sections of this book set in the 1970s place characters and action, including Yarik, who has gone over there to restage a play that he did while in hiding as a Jewish child during the Holocaust in India. And the real event of the Naxalite insurrection. Again, we're in a historical fiction situation here where different characters that you've created, that you've breathed life into, are experiencing this very real and deeply politicizing deeply politicizing event, like reading this in a time of like relative social discord in the United States. Some of the like dialogue around, oh, we think protesters are like wrecking stuff for the sake of it or creating needless violence, or if they're reclaiming land for the people, or if they're being politically puppeted. How did you take your characters that you were creating and find a political situation or compass for them? And where in creating a character did their political leanings fall? Like, as you were conceptualizing a character, I guess I could say, how strongly did that factor into how you created a person? Or was it sort of an afterthought that followed from their life situation?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that place informs character. I think politics informs character. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And I'm drawn toward fiction that is willing to look at all aspects of characters mm-hmm. and how they present themselves to the world. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's really important. I mean, one of the practices that I do when I'm writing short stories or a novel mm-hmm. is I ask my characters a series of questions. And mm-hmm. some of those questions involve their political leanings, like uh-huh. how they think about political choices that they have made in their lives.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious about the answers that they provide. And it's important yeah. for me as a writer to have a sense of who they are politically in this world, what yeah. positions they're passionate about or not passionate about. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's going to make its way onto the page, you know, if it's mm-hmm. appropriate to have it in scene, if it's in service to the novel.
Yeah.
But it feels very important to me as a writer to have that sense of who the character is, to not forget about their political role in this world.
Yeah. Well, we're on the topic of the time you spend with your characters and the way you kind of converse with them, even outside the role of the novel. Where in your writing process does this typically land? Like, is an I do it first? Is it an I do it every week or every day or when you need to process something?
Yeah, I typically start out my writing practice by writing in the voice of one of my characters. So, you know, mm-hmm. if I'm working on Lucy's chapter, I would start out writing in Lucy's journal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I have, I'll start out typically by doing the free write in Lucy's voice. And then I have a list of questions that I sometimes go back to.
Yeah.
If I'm feeling like I want to explore a particular area. But it's the thing I do, you know, pretty typically to start a writing practice, because it makes me feel like I'm a little bit closer to the character and yeah. more open to surprise. I want my characters to surprise me on the page. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not writing, at least in the first draft, with an outline. So, you know, I'm very excited by what they're going to do. And yeah. that gets me closer to that possibility.
Yeah. No worries if you don't have an answer prepared for this, but is there something that springs to mind that was a very exciting realization about one of your characters that you didn't necessarily anticipate in like an outlining or broader phase that they kind of told you? It's okay if you don't have an example. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there are various minor characters in this mm-hmm. novel, like Mrs. Paul. Mm-hmm. And it used to be the case that some of them had much more major roles.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Paul in particular, you know, I learned so much about her as a character and about her backstory and her late relationship with her husband. Uh-huh. And, you know, I feel like those learnings are things that I might take on maybe to a future story or a future novel. So I feel yeah. like with each of the characters, whether they make it onto the main stage or not, like I have yeah. a lot of material that I then shape into future work.
Cool. So let's steer back a little bit to talking a little more about Yarik's brain, something that I love to talk about. In Gopalpur, India, in that kind of segment of the book where Yarik is over working on the play, spending time with the community, he bonds with a local child named Neil. They spend time together. They teach each other things. Neil teaches Yarik some local stuff. Yarik provides kind of a big brother support vibe to him. And it kind of felt to me as I read like Yarik was trying to provide to Neil what Misha had provided to him, especially as a lot of the male role models in Neil's life were getting taken away by the conflict in the area. But Yarik was also, with everything there's an opportunity cost, Yarik was spending this time with Neil at the cost of going back to the United States to spend time with Lucy, who was pregnant with his child at the time. Do you think that Yarik is either consciously or unconsciously hiding from intimacy or fearing failure? Or do you think just his need to connect in that like familial sense and more of like a sibling type way or a fatherly type way more imminently felt more important?
Well, I think both things are true. Mm-hmm. So I think he is hiding from intimacy. I think he has a deep fear of intimacy with Lucy, of falling completely in love.
Yeah.
And I think it's also true as a real connection to Neil and to the village, mm-hmm. and feels like the work that he is doing there is meaningful.
Yeah.
So, you know, I appreciate it that it's a real tension for him, that he's not just hiding from his intimacy,
yeah,
but that, you know, he also feels like he's, you know, in service to this greater good, in service to this village.
Mm-hmm. For anyone who's just joining us, we're speaking with Jai Chakrabarty, author of Play at the End of the World. To dig a little into the role of art in this book, which is always a fun thing to talk about, the role of writing within writing, the role of art within art. The play at the center of the book, that is the central thread of the book, connecting Poland and India, connecting Yarik's childhood to his adulthood, is seen by various people in the book. Like this play keeps getting performed in these really, really high stakes environments and situations. At various times, it's seen as a valuable way to prepare children for the concept of mortality. It's seen as a way to build hope for the future in a time of upset and uncertainty. It's seen as an object of academic study. For Yarik, it seems like a way to take his experiences and build them into something meaningful, to build them into something that creates a more positive present and future. But towards the end of the book, there are ways in which the revolutionary value of the play is called into question, kind of the motives of the performance of it called into question, and the idealism of those performing it. As you, also a writer, created this story, did you mean to use the play as a discussion about the value and limits of art, or does it have a more straightforward role of an object many people can reflect and project their own meaning on? And of course, this is you can do an or an and.
Yeah, what a great question. And just for folks who may not be aware, this particular play, Dakkor, translated as the post office, was written by Rabindranath Tagore in 1912. It's been translated into many languages and performed in at many critical moments in our history. So it was mm-hmm. performed in Paris the night before the city fell to the Germans. And then, of course, as it relates to this book, it was performed in Warsaw in 1942, weeks before deportations. Mm-hmm. So the play in the historical record has so many different meanings,
yeah,
you know, as it does in this book, mm-hmm. right? It is not seen in one way in our sort of our history of that particular piece of performance.
Yeah.
And I was really influenced by researching street art and mm-hmm. street theater in India in the 1970s. So there are a number of notable playwrights from that era, but Safdar Hashmi, for example, who was a communist playwright mm-hmm. and performed plays in the streets of New Delhi. Mm-hmm. So he was always kind of risking this line between art as a vehicle for political change, mm-hmm. but also art as something that could incite violence.
Yeah.
You know, those were things that were perennially together in the work of Safdar Hashmi, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that I wanted to explore all of this. I wanted to explore this play that can bring a community together, that can uplift mm-hmm. and heal, but also this play that can be performed with politically fraught connotations and can be quite yeah. challenging for the community when we think about its after effects.
Yeah. I'll say with historical fiction, this was a really, really excellent place to insert some of the history. Like, while reading this, of course, I was occasionally Googling names or things like that to see what fell on which side of the historical fiction line. And the idea to incorporate a play with these already grand historical implications and to bring it further is such a great way to kind of piece apart and look at what a play can really do across many different situations and in many different hands. We're almost to the end of our time, and I really, really appreciate having you here. This has been so much fun. Is there anything you're working on right now that you're excited about or want to shout out? If not, that's okay, but we're always excited to see what you do. I'd love to have you back sometime.
Yeah, I'm working on a collection of short stories that Knopf will be publishing in 2023. Oh. And it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank
and
you
for
so
any
much.
Readers who have feedback, I love connecting with readers, so feel free to reach out.
Thank you so much. For everyone listening at home, this is KFAI 90.3 FM and live on the web at kfai.org. We've been speaking to Jai Chakrabarty. His novel, A Play at the End of the World, is out now. It's been excellent speaking with you. Take care. Have a good night.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye.